Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with e-patient Dave DeBroncart, the founding member of the Society for Participatory Medicine. In the Tech Report segment, Lauren Bonner introduces us to Kelly Young, who started a website for rheumatoid arthritis sufferers. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea recognizes that a range of factors, including the built environment, can determine health. Mercy Housing California, a nonprofit development company, decided to collaborate with the city of San Francisco as well as community-based organizations on a project that would combine development and health. Their plans include transforming the city's largest public housing community, Sunnydale. It consists of 800 units housing 1,700 people on 50 acres of land, but most residents live in poverty, there's no grocery store, and violence is pervasive. The revitalization of Sunnydale is part of Hope San Francisco initiative to reinvent distressed public housing communities, and it's San Francisco's largest anti-poverty collaboration in decades. The housing units will be redeveloped into a mixed-income community with a life center for fitness, family programming, a health clinic, educational facilities, green space, grocery stores, and a farmers market. In addition, developers are working with researchers at the University of California to collect baseline data on the social and physical needs of the residents so that their health and well-being can be measured over time. Last spring, after several months of community meetings with Sunnydale residents, a master plan for the revitalization of San Francisco's Sunnydale neighborhood was finalized. Recognizing the impact that community development can have on health, uniting a city, and bringing hope to underserved populations, now that's a bright idea.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dave DeBroncart, also known as ePatient Dave. He's the founding member and on the board of directors of the Society for Participatory Medicine, in addition to being a well-known blogger and speaker on the topics of ePatients. Welcome, Dave.
You know, thanks very much.
We hear the term participatory medicine brought up often these days in healthcare, but the term ePatients may be less familiar to our listeners. Can you tell us what an e-patient is and how you became one?
It's funny because I was one long before I knew the term exists. The E stands for empowered, engaged, equipped, enabled. Some these days people are saying educated about evidence, sort of a pick your own E thing. The term was invented by a doctor named Tom Ferguson, who coined this term e-patient, and he started spotting individuals who were beginning to do the things that he anticipated. So one of the people he spotted was a guy named Jill Friedman, who had founded ACOR.org, A-C-O-R, which is a network of listservs, just plain text, simple mailing lists for people with different cancers. I ended up joining that. Turns out it's the best source of kidney cancer information in the world. Another one he spotted was my primary physician, Danny Sands, who in 1997 wrote the first published guidelines for how to do doctor-patient email effectively. And so when I had my cancer adventure in 2007 and recovered, the following year, Dr. Sands invited me to go on this annual retreat with this band of internet crazies. And I read their manifesto called the ePatient White Paper and immediately spotted myself in those pages because the behaviors that were described there just matched what I had done. So I did have a blog. In fact, my first post on that blog was 4 years ago today. And I had called it The New Life of Patient Dave, and I just renamed myself ePatient Dave.
Dave, you've been a champion and a crusader, really, in this e-patient movement and in opening up access for patients to specialists, to each other for support, but also just access to your own data. And one outcome you experienced that you found was that, you know, the data might not always be as accurate as it should be. And some of that, and I know this is getting into a bit of detail, but for our listeners, I think this is important. You found that the data being used to describe people, reflect people, is their claims data, the data that people select for billing purposes more than the data that might be in the chart itself, and more specific and more accurate. How have you worked to correct this, and why is that important to our listeners?
Well, you know, it's funny because my career and this whole thing of me being thrust into being an international keynote speaker and blogger on healthcare, I knew nothing about any of this until I got sick. And then I didn't really know anything about it until after I got better and started studying it. But my career has been in high tech, where we do things with data. Most, not all, but most electronic medical record systems in hospitals and doctors' offices have been cost justified by the ability to bill insurance, not by the ability to create a good record for us. And it turns out, without getting too geeky here, it turns out there are numerous reasons why the data that you need for insurance billing is not the data that you need for a good, accurate medical picture of your health. So the first thing I think it's important for people to understand is that your billing records are different from your clinical records, your medical real medical information. And unfortunately, the billing records are more likely to be automated than your real medical records, which are likely to exist in paper or just in a really uncomputerized pile of text. And the reason this is important, and I would encourage everybody, your hospital may tell you otherwise, but you are entitled under law to get a copy of your medical record. It may take, they're allowed to be stodgy and take 30 days or even 60 to give it to you. And in some states, they're allowed to charge ridiculous amounts of money, but you can get at it, and those rules are changing.
Huh, that's a very interesting point. And, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, there's an initiative in all the states to develop health information technology exchanges, so providers can put their information out there and other providers can access them. But more importantly, patients can access them. Have you been working on those or have been a resource to those authorities as they think about the issues? You know, there are a lot of the inside the beltway. Do you opt into this or opt out? But I want to talk more about the bigger picture of really trying to push out access to people's medical information, whether it's their primary care provider, a specialist, or the hospital. How do you see this movement developing, and how are you helping inform it?
I am a child of the 60s. I came to Boston, to college from Minnesota, in the middle of the protest years, the consciousness raising about feminism and civil rights. And in any movement like that, there is this awakening phase, as I say, consciousness raising, like, oh, I didn't realize that was going on. I didn't know there was anything there to pay attention to. So, I mean, I myself, when I got sick 5 years ago this winter, or when I discovered I was almost dead, I just presumed that everything about doctors and hospitals was perfect. And I was saved by magnificent doctors at a magnificent hospital, no question about that. But I had no comprehension of how poor most of the computer systems are to support them. You know, today it's not possible, for instance, for a commercial airliner to take off with its flaps in the wrong position. Mm-hmm. There was a day when that sort of mistake would cause a fatal crash. Today, that's been engineered out of, you just can't do that anymore. Well, protections like that don't exist in hospitals to keep doctors and nurses from making honest mistakes. So I advocate two things. First of all, I advocate for us, the patients, the consumers, whatever you want to call us, to be responsible and take an active role in helping make sure that the information is as good as it can be. And I also advocate for physicians to open their minds and hearts to realize that it's not pointless to get that kind of help from somebody who hasn't been to medical school. Now, I'm fond of saying that I'm not a doctor. I didn't even know I was sick. I couldn't have diagnosed myself and so on. And yet, when I looked at my radiology reports, you don't have to be a doctor to notice that, for instance, one of my x-rays identified me as a 53-year-old woman. Now, why, with a clearly male name attached to it, somebody could have put 53-year-old woman in radiology report? I don't know how that can happen, but the point is you may be more able as a consumer and you may benefit more as a physician from having the patient actively involved in improving the quality of the medical record.
You know, Dave, we often talk about training the next generation on the show and look at areas where we need to really improve the training of physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals to accomplish our goals. But this area around the engaged patient, the e-patient, as we describe it, the use of information and electronic communication might be just one area where the current generation of people who are training actually come to this de novo with this as a skill set. What's your work been or your connection been to students of the health professionals, and what's your sense for how they will carry this into their future careers? Are we looking really at a new generation that comes to this philosophy and this set of activities naturally?
You know, I would just love to have the chance to participate in medical education because you hit the nail on the head. You know, I blogged last month about something I'd stumbled across from Max Planck, the magnificent physicist from 100 years ago, who said something, I don't have it in front of me for the exact wording, but it's something about new scientific truths are not adopted because people change their minds. New scientific truths are adopted because the old farts die off and a new generation comes along that wasn't raised with the old erroneous view. And so here's a tangible example of that. At conference after conference and on blog after blog, I've heard physicians say, I'm not doing email with my patients unless there's an insurance billing code for it. But a year and a half ago, I participated in my hospital's lean quality improvement workshop, and we had an interesting mix of people there. Nurse case managers, attending physicians, and a bunch of kids, I could say, fresh out of medical school. And to them, it's like, what do you mean not do email? Of course I'll do email. That's how you talk to people, you know? And so, indeed, if we can connect with students in the school find ways that will be acceptable in the culture of medicine to connect them to the idea of the engaged patient. Really, there's no telling what may be possible.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today, we're speaking with Dave DeBroncart, also known as ePatient Dave. And I want to pull the thread a little on that of the culture of medicine. Certainly, the internet is become available and information's more accessible to individuals at a click of a button. But if you look at the younger generation of people out there, social media is the way they communicate. They actually aren't emailing. They're on their Facebook or, in fact, they're texting and the like. What do you see the role of social media playing in all of this around engaging and activating patients?
Well, if you want to talk about activating patients to connect with each other, that's a whole different game than doctor-patient communication. I personally think that it's a good idea for doctors and patients to have their care relationship in an electronic medical record system so that it's all archived in one place. But on the other hand, we the aphorism that I've heard recently is, in social media, talk about medicine, but don't practice medicine.
That's a good one.
So you have, for instance, two doctors who spring to mind, in fact, three, who do this brilliantly. There's Wendy Sue Swanson, who's a pediatrician and mother in Seattle. Her Twitter name and Facebook page are Seattle Mama Doc. Then there's Jeff Livingstone in Texas. His identity is Mac OBGYN. He says that by putting out good information to his patients, most of whom are young women who are on Facebook, by putting information out there, by being where they are, he sees them making better choices and having better results. And this is, in that manifesto that I mentioned earlier that Tom Ferguson was working on when he died and his team finished afterwards, one of their seven preliminary conclusions was, as much as possible, healthcare should take place on the patient's turf, be where the patient is. And, in every other industry, they know that being located, especially in retail, being located where people already are is how you get better results. And then the third physician doing social media, and there are others who will kill me for not mentioning them. Forgive
okay.
me. The third one is an orthopedist named Howard Lux, L-U-K-S, who has, he decided that he'd like to converse with people on his blog with videos. So he just switches on his webcam, records 5 minutes of discussion about a topic. And just to show how this sharing of technologies can work, I said, Howard, that's great that you have these YouTubes on your blog, but the words you said can't be found by Google. And so he found a cheap transcription service. So now he records the video and then takes the text and pastes it in so that it works both ways. So at a deeper level, what's changing here, I was trained years ago as a structural thinker to deconstruct a situation, look for how is value flowing from point to point. How do people or players in the ecosystem who have a need, how do they go looking for it and how do they connect with that resource? What's happening here is that you could say 50 years ago, all ability to create value in medicine resided with people who'd been to medical school. The access to information in the libraries, the ability to do diagnoses, the knowledge of available treatments, and so on. And so many of those things, including the skill of a brilliant caregiving physician or nurse, are still true. But it's no longer true that the only access to useful information and the only access to good medical advice comes from your local physician. Now, that can seem threatening to some people, but it does no good to just feel threatened and stick your head in the sand. The question is, how do you adjust? People like Wendy Sue Swanson, Jeff Livingstone, Howard Lux are becoming participants in that new information ecosystem. They're putting information out there for others to find, and they go out and they look for information as well.
Today we've been speaking with Dave DeBronkart, also known as ePatient Dave, a founding member and on the board of directors of the Society for Participatory Medicine. He's also a well-known blogger and speaker on the topic of ePatients. Dave, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Another well-known e-patient joins us on the show today. Kelly Young is the founder of RA Warrior, the largest website for rheumatoid arthritis, and the president of the Rheumatoid Patient Foundation, a nonprofit working to improve the lives of people with rheumatoid disease. Hi, Kelly. Why did you start this blog, RA Warrior?
When I was diagnosed with RA in 2006, there wasn't a lot of good information available to patients. And I found that there was also a lot of conflicting information on various websites and between medical journals or books that you could get at the library and between what patients were saying themselves about their experiences. So since I had the perspective of a patient living with the disease, I decided to eventually create a place online for patients to go and find good information.
What do you think has been most helpful on the blog for other e-patients?
I think the thing that people say to me most often when they write me is that they felt crazy, or that before they found the blog, they felt like they were the only one who had the experience that they had. So, for example, there's so many things, so many examples I could give, but for example, morning stiffness. This is something that I kind of explain as akin to morning sickness with pregnancy. Most women who've been pregnant have been nauseous, but it's not true that most of them are only nauseous in the morning. And so with RA, very often people are told that they'll only be stiff in the morning, but usually patients have stiffness all the time, either stiffness all day or stiffness brought on by activity or stiffness brought on by rest. And so this is a very common symptom that patients experience. And when they're talking to each other about it, they can describe more about what it's actually really like. But when you read about it in a book, it sounds like, well, for a few minutes in the morning, it's kind of stiff, and then you move around, and then it's really okay. But that's really not the experience of patients. So when patients are connecting together, they're able to compare with each other and realize that they're not alone and that their experience is not unusual. And that has a lot of consequences emotionally for patients and helping them to want to improve their own care. But like I said, also even to the wider community for awareness.
And recently, I understand that you attended for the second time the American College of Rheumatology Scientific Meeting. How was that?
I did. I would say that's definitely been the high point of our new foundation's experience in our first year. We call it the RPF. And so the RPF had our first exhibit at the ACR, and we presented a video called The Faces of Rheumatoid Disease, and we created some scientific posters using current research, just presenting it from the patient point of view about the need for people to understand the variations in the disease and the variability of response to treatment. And we had, about a dozen patients come from different places in the country to work in our exhibit booth and to represent the foundation and represent the face of the patient. And this, I don't think this has ever been done before at the ACR, that there were RA patients there, presenting to the scientific community and, to doctors who give clinical care and nurses organizations and other nonprofits. This is the voice of the RA patients. So, It was very, very exciting step for the RPF.
Great. That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Kelly.
Thank you, Lauren.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.